everybody. Welcome to another installment of Innovation Crush. My name is Chris Denson. My Twitter handle is Densonology, Densonology.
And you had to slip OG in there.
I did, because you've seen the show, and you've seen me in the streets. So in case you don't know by now, this show is where we talk to a lot of really innovative, interesting people behind great ideas and just really cool stuff in the world. So today, my guest is a guy by the name of Steve Bellinger.
Whoa, roar from the crowd.
Anthony just did the one-man wave.
Yeah.
He stood up and just sat down.
Rather sad.
He's like, I was going to leave, but...
That's better attention than I get at home, so that's pretty good. It's a better reception. I like that.
I was going to leave, but I'm not even interested enough to walk out of the room.
I'm glad that all the innovative people couldn't make it today, and then I was able to slip in. That was good.
Speaking of innovative people,
yes.
Give us the 101 on Steve Bellinger. Who are you? Where'd you come from? What do you do?
Right now, I am a writer, actor, / stay-at-home dad. So that's my job, is changing diapers and watching Dora the Explorer.
Nice. How old are the kids?
6 and 3. Yeah.
And you're still in diapers, huh?
The little guy. I'm trying to get him out of diapers. He is costing me money.
Yeah, well, I have a 1.5-year-old.
And
We're nowhere near.
You're stuck for a while. Yeah. Now, very personal question. You're sticking on one, or are you going for...
Well, there's a 9-year-old as well.
There's a 9-year-old. Oh, wow. So you had a big spread.
Yes, okay. Exactly. Well, I figured I could have help at that point. I was like, I don't want to hire a nanny. I just put the 9-year-old to
work. See, the 3-year spread... Like, just as the oldest one was getting out of stuff, I was like, oh, look, another fucking baby. That's awesome.
Get out of the cabinet.
I literally got my vasectomy as soon as we got that kid in the car to come home from the hospital.
Nice. And you also bought the video with you, right? So we can post it to the...
Absolutely. Okay. It's on YouTube. It's on pretty much everywhere.
Yeah. Your tube.
My tube. Is there a my tube?
I'm sure there is.
There will be now.
So historically, like, you know, when I look at your resume, right, I see a very long stint as an executive at Penthouse.
I have two different resumes. I have my corporate resume,
yes,
which is the 16-year span where I was doing what you're supposed to do.
Right.
Go to work.
And look at naked.
Oh, well, for 8 years I worked at Penthouse Magazine, which is, I guess, not what everybody does. But yeah, it was just a basic boring job in a place that sold pictures of naked ladies.
Right.
And then I went to Time Inc. for 8 years and was a corporate executive. And then I put the brakes on and dropped out of corporate life to become a stand-up and a writer. And
why did you do that?
I wasn't happy.
Yeah.
And it sounds so stupid to say that, but I was making a ton of money. I kept getting promoted. I was the corporate vice president at Time Inc.
Wow.
My job was great. I could, you know, I played a lot of corporate golf. My boss was cool by the time I left. But at the end of the day, I was still a numbers pusher. I was on the finance side.
Yeah.
And I had started doing stand-up and acting on the side.
Okay.
I was like, that's...
Was it just like, just because? Is that something that you were always interested in? You know?
All right. Here's a secret for you, Chris. When I was 21 years old, I said, I'm going to be a writer. That's what I always kind of wanted to do as a kid. I'm like,
right.
I like being creative. I like that stuff. I moved to New York City. And I sent a couple of pitches out to magazines like Esquire, New York, you know, this is late 80s. Got a couple of not even horrible rejections. Like, not like you should never be a writer.
Don't ever do this again.
Break all your pencils and go fill out, except for one, and use that to go fill out an application at McDonald's. I got two very nice rejections saying, hey, great story. We have something like this in the works. Keep us posted.
That's a really good way of putting it.
Right, that's
going to steal that from
that's so nice. And the other one was very similar vein. It wasn't like F off or the dreaded no response. It was timely responses that said nice but not quite right for us. And for some reason, to my 21-year-old head, that was the ultimate rejection. I put all the pencils down and didn't touch writing again for like a decade.
Wow.
Which I don't know if it was a confidence crusher or just something. And then I started making more money on the corporate side and I got lazy.
Right.
Right, you keep getting promoted. Oh, yeah. You keep getting money.
You get comfortable. I don't know if lazy is the right word. Like you got lazy obviously on the dream.
On the dream, absolutely.
But as far as like the money adds a lot of comfort. And plus all the perks, right?
It was all the perks.
Two huge publications.
Yeah, I mean I was working at nationally, I mean at Penthouse, I was a vice president there. I was running $1 million company.
Right.
At 28 years old. So I had a lot of leeway. I had a lot of dispensable cash. Things were going well. And I was like, oh, I would like to write, but eh. Yeah. I have money. I can drink.
Which is crazy because since you were at a publication, you're like, oh, like you're the vice president. You're like, you can slip one. You never just slipped one in there and like use a pseudonym.
That's how.
Who's this Jerry Sadler guy? just a guy I know. Don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it. It'll be fine.
When I started the dream back up again, so to speak, it was kind of right around 9/11, which is a whole nother mind fuck. But I was working at Popular Science and I hung out. I was the head of the finance side, but I hung out with all the editors making $15,000 a year. Mm. And I actually would slip in some articles. Mm. Like they would review gear and, oh, we got this fancy golf club. Nobody golfs. I'm like, oop, raise my hand. I golf. I'll write that up for you.
Right.
So I would write like some video game box reviews, stuff like that, which never got paid for. And I didn't care. You know, I just wanted the bylines to help get me to the next spot.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then I started doing both. Where I was, you know, magic suit guy every day for like 60 hours a week. Then I would just take off the suit and go do Caroline's or The Cellar and do a couple of stand-up sets, do improv.
So wait, you stopped, let's say you stopped at 21, right? You sent the letters in. Yep. You're like, no, never mind. How long was it before you actually like, okay, I'm going to hit the stage? Or like you got the itch to go, ooh, I need to.
See, so I probably stopped in 89.
Yep.
And didn't happen again until the summer of 2001.
I can't do that math, but it's a long time.
Is that 30 years?
Yes, it's like 40, 50 years.
No, man. So it's over a decade. So that's 12, 13 years. Wow. And I kind of, at Time Inc., I kept moving up. And I'm like, oh, man, it was one of those, I love the money. Everybody loves making the money. But I hated what I was doing.
Right.
And I hated a couple of my bosses. Like, things got wacky.
Okay.
And then things all lined up where I had a good boss, a good company. Everything was going great. I'm like, oh, I still hate my job. What happened? All the things I was blaming it on got better. And I was like, no, this isn't what I want to do. So I started doing it kind of both. That's when I started jumping into some acting classes and doing improv and doing stand-up.
So what, you know, as you've transitioned now for close to another decade, right?
I quit corporate gig in 2004. So yeah, it's been 10 years.
Right. What have you taken from your corporate experience that kind of helps you on like the creative side?
I mean, I always had confidence on the business side, which sounds so crazy just because I didn't know any better.
Right.
Like I seemed to be doing well at it and I just kept blasting through. And I've said this before, I think because I'm tall, and I have a decent voice, people give me that Morgan Freeman gravitas. I'm like, I don't know shit about shit. But I go in, and the improv I think I was doing.
You're like 17. Yeah. And you just get up and walk out.
That's what I used to do. Like, if I didn't know anything, I would yes and it. Like, and this is before I knew anything about improv. Uh-huh. Like, I would be running a meeting with 20 people, and they'd say, well, we need to do X, Y, and Z to get the budget figure. Steve, is that okay? Absolutely. Let's go forward with that, but only Z, not X. Okay, let's go.
Right.
And then I would always go back to my office and go, oh, fuck, what did they ask? And then I'd figure it out. And if I ever made a mistake, I would just go back and say, you know what? We've rethought that. We're going to do this. But because I was quick in the room, everybody thought I knew what I was doing.
Well, that's also like that speaks to – I always feel like – because I have a very similar background, right?
Okay.
I did the reverse. I did stand-up comedy. Like I started doing that when I was 17, wrote – you know, had my first writing job at the age of 22.
Okay.
And just – like I still write to this day, but I love – the idea of ideas and like how to make an idea happen. So that just happened to become a little bit more corporate marketing. I run an innovation team for a very well-known marketing agency and we have a lot of fun.
Nice.
But I think some of that comedic timing and that ability to be improvisational works not only on stage, but in a boardroom. Right.
Well, now that you're in the corporate world, like it's a pretty boring place.
Right.
So in meetings, like, again, coming from Penthouse, which served me well because it wasn't a real company, like, it was kind of a clusterfuck of a place where I my personality did very well. Sorry, are we allowed to curse on this show?
Yes, there's
– on my 14th
F-bomb. My pastor's
F-bomb.
Not listening, I don't think. Shout out to Oasis.
Nice.
Long story.
So by the time I got to real magazines, I was like, this is me, you know, and I was just always off the cuff. And that always served me well, and I've said throughout my time at Time Inc., I kept getting promoted, I think, just because I'm a good guy to have in the room.
Right.
Like, everybody can kind of do the job. But if it's between me and the CPA, who, you know, thinks a pencil is funny, you're going to want to take me on a sales meeting.
And so, did your sense of humor come out in your day-to-day work?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And when I finally started doing, like, stand-up, like, I did it in the closet for like 6 months. That's the wrong term. I did it. You know, I did it on
you
the slide
for on
6 months.
But, just don't say fire truck like you did earlier.
Oh, we're going to ride fire trucks later. doing stand-up in a closet would be really sad.
Yeah, that would be sad.
For well, audience of
none.
Got
to practice somewhere.
When I finally like started saying to people, like, that's what I was doing, like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, okay, yeah, yeah, you shouldn't be doing the suit and tie right. thing. What was I going to say? There was something important there.
I don't know, improv and business and being in the room and just having that spontaneity. Ability. That's okay. We'll get it back.
That's a brain fart. Old man brain fart.
This is all a full circles show.
Line up fire trucks and we'll take care of it.
So, you know, you've had some successes since you left, obviously. Like, I feel like, you know, when I look at your resume, and obviously the business background has helped, especially being at a higher level in the organization. It's not like you were, you know, a contributor. And
yeah.
And you're like, I'm going to do stand-up now. Like, so... You've been able to parlay that into books, right? Or a book? Or?
I got one book so far.
Okay.
Under my belt about my years at Penthouse.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say the best thing that the corporate world gave me was...
A book.
The book was good, but also the financial security.
Right.
To do what I'm doing now.
Right, right.
Because, you know, my peers in acting in New York are living hand to mouth.
Right.
Even the comics. You know, I interview a ton of people for my show. And people who are doing very well still live in tiny little apartments in New York and are barely scraping by. I'm like, that's a tough way to go through life.
Like, sucks for you, man. Yeah. Thanks for coming on the show.
I'm going to go eat a lobster tail. A lobster tail stuffed with some crab claws.
And also, I might have dessert.
No, that is dessert after two steaks.
Right.
No, I'm not rich. I made enough money where... We can survive.
Right.
You know, I got two kids. I still worry about the future. Last year, I figured it out when I did my taxes. Last year, I made as much as I made in 1988, my first year working at Penthouse. Like, that's not a good bar to meet.
Prices have gone up a little bit since then.
And I have two kids in a house and scary, scary taxes.
Do you think you would have eventually been compelled to make the same decision if you did not have that financial security?
No, you know, this is quitting the job is something we've talked about a ton of times. It was scary as shit, dude, because I was making six figures.
Right.
Like, there was even a little time before that when I had a shitty boss where I was really actively, I think, trying to get fired. I'm like, shit, give me 6 months, a year of severance.
Right.
You know, I can take that, do stand up and bury myself in the creative side and do great. But they would never force me out. They actually promoted me again. I don't know how that happened. But when I left, you know, thank God my wife was crazy supportive.
Right.
Because if she would have not been on board, I would never have done it. Because, like, you know, literally right. when we were talking about it, I'm like, I'm thinking of quitting the job with the big, big paycheck to go do the thing that pays $15.
Like, okay.
She
was it that simple, or was it like, all right, let's plan this out?
Somebody had a producer had met with me and stuff was helping me out with some stuff, and she had told me over lunch one day, she's like, man, look at you, you're so unhappy with your job, you just have to pick, you know, just bury the creative stuff again for another 10 years and just follow the corporate path and you'll probably do well. Or if you want to do the creative stuff, you got to do it, because you can't do that with one foot in,
right?
Which is kind of what I was doing.
Yeah.
And she said simply, just quit your job. And I went home at night literally like thinking that was the funniest thing ever and told my wife, I'm like, yeah, the crazy bitch said, why don't you just quit your job? And I still remember we were laying in bed in the dark and she said, well, why don't you? I'm like, ooh, that's a crazy supportive wife.
That's awesome.
Like, and we talked about it for a couple of days. I'm like, all right, let's do this.
Nice.
And the first Monday morning I was home, it was terrifying.
I bet. Like, because you've been working since your 20s.
And, like, you know, like, and grown-up stuff. Owned a house, woke up at 6 in the morning to commute into Manhattan. You know, it was like a movie. That's I was doing, getting home at 8 o'clock at night, and all of a sudden it's just, the world is my oyster.
So I'm going to get back into the book in a second, but just kind of, like you said, you have two resumes. Yep. What is, give us some highlights from the post, you know, corporate career.
Man, there's some cool. I've done TV, you know, back when the soaps were in New York. I would work on the soaps every once in a while. Never like anything anybody would remember. But all my children, they would keep having me on. And at some point, I think the second or third time, they just stopped giving my character a name. Like, I was a bank manager. And then I'd be like a month later, I would be like telling somebody that somebody died. I was the prison psychologist. I'm like, you think anybody? No, our guys don't care. Nobody cares. Like maybe if your mom's watching it, she'll go, oh, wait a minute. He was just working in a bank last week. I was always like then eventually once they found like a white doctor's coat that fit me,
yeah.
They would just keep bringing me in for any doctor role that had to say something important. Well, he died in the prison riot. Cut to something else. And then when I first quit, I've talked about this a ton on my show. It was the worst timing in the world in New York because all the shows went away.
Right.
It was Law and Order, and that's it.
Which everybody has. Have you done?
And I'm the only one. I've never been on a Law and Order.
Shout out to Law and Order. I'm looking in the mic like they can see me.
Are you in there? Are you in there, Mr. Wolf?
There's the book. You've been contributing to Men's Health.
I mean, I actually hosted the Men's Health podcast for 3 years, which, you know, I spent 3 years just interviewing the biggest celebrities and athletes and all my football idols and acting idols.
How'd that come about? Like that seems like an amazing, because I love podcasting, as you guys can tell, right?
Yeah.
You can tell, Anthony. how did that come about? Like, you know.
When I worked at Popular Science, I would sneak in articles. One of the guys there was, you know, third or fourth in the chain of command. He had left to go work at Men's Health. Lost touch with him.
Right.
About 2 or 3 years into my creative life, I had just scored a thing on a pilot for NBC, Kidnapped.
Right.
This time I was an important guy with a gun saying three lines about somebody who died.
Did you have a doctor's coat on too?
No, I was full Army SWAT team.
Right? Oh, nice.
Yeah, sweating like a motherfucker. But I was running around the rooftops of Brooklyn. It was like I was a kid again. It was fantastic.
That's so cool.
And I, out of the blue, he had reached out to me saying he was, you know, still at Men's Health. He was like number two there. He's like, you went back to corporate world, right? There's no way you're still acting. Like you didn't still give up all that money.
There's no way you really followed
your dream. Nobody ever does that. I'm like, oh no, I'm still doing it. I just scored an NBC thing. It was pretty cool.
Right.
And so he had me write an article for Men's Health. A feature about quitting my job and following your dream, which was read by 12 million people.
That's awesome.
Inbox was filled with all these people. Oh my God, you're such an inspiration. There's still a few people that was in 08. One of the guys was living in Seattle. Mm-hmm. He's like, you've inspired me. I'm going to fight. He moved to Nashville. Now he's like touring with country acts as like a touring guitarist.
Huh.
He's doing phenomenal. Another kid was in Florida. He's like, I've always wanted to do stand-up, man. That's inspirational. I hope I get the ball someday. Kind of talked him through it. He moved to New York, started doing stand-up. I'm like, that's cool to inspire people to that point. And then I kept writing for Men's Health, doing some stuff here and there for them. And at some point, whoever was doing their podcast got another job. And most magazines are like, I don't know. Who's going to do it?
He went on tour as a guitarist.
He went on tour as a guitarist. Yeah, I ruined his career. I guess in the back of his head, again, the same guy said, oh, do you want to host our podcast? Because, you know, nobody really wants to step up and do it. I'm like, yeah. And it was the first couple of episodes were just me in a room like this interviewing editors. And I was like, all right, guys.
This is not.
I'm like, it was very – their old podcast was very NPR.
Right. Okay.
So on today's show, we'll be talking about diamond push-ups. I'm like, oh, my God, I can't do that. And they would – you know, I would interview editors. I'm like, nobody wants to go to a podcast to hear about the article they just read in this month.
It's called Transmedia.
Yeah. I'm like, all right, if you want to do that, that's fine, but that's not for me. I said, how about – I know some people in showbiz. I got connections. Can I interview some people? I don't think they cared one way or the other. They were probably going to kill it. Then I came out here. I talked to Adam Carolla, who I'd worked with, Todd Glass. We did the first couple episodes. And they're like, oh, yeah, that's kind of good. We just keep doing that.
Yeah.
Like, okay. So it just built from there.
What did you during that time, that 3 years, and also Penthouse, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do you know about men?
Very little.
And you're a stay-at-home dad. Like, I feel like there's been so – such a weird shift in how men are perceived or said to act or whatever. Like all the rules around manhood have changed.
Yes.
Right? From the metrosexual to the...
even the media portrayal, like in the 80s, I think we're the same, roughly the same generation-ish. Yeah. You look much younger than me, but I'm going to put myself myself with you.
I put a leather cleaner on my face.
I'm covered in bronzer right now. But like in the 80s, it was Rambo. It was John McClane. It was like these guys, oily bull hunks.
Right.
I'm like, that wasn't me. You know, when I left college, I was 150 pounds.
Go ahead. Were you 150 pounds? Like, how tall are you?
I'm 6'3", and I was literally 150
That's
pounds.
Scary.
I was a newborn colt. Like, I could barely control my arms and legs. But yeah, I've always been like, I think the point of view about men has changed more to my, because I never fit in. I was never, like, even in college, I wasn't one of those, get drunk and rape. I wasn't a frat guy. But the point of view of men, like, we have become dumbed down in the media.
Right.
Like, every guy now in a commercial is like, what? It gets better gas mileage? Cool. Like, they're always the dumb dad.
Right.
And it has become, you know, Michael Cera is like the prototypical male. Right? Yeah. I love Galifianakis, but like, that's now the benchmark. Like, the in shape buff guys are almost like being pushed out.
Right. Or they're just doing the epic historical action, like the Hercules.
Yes.
Or, you know.
Is it wrong that when I saw that they were doing The Rock with Hercules, I just thought that was a goof? It just seems so spot on. I'm like, no, that's not. That's like an SNL skit, right? That's not right.
Right, exactly. I saw somebody, there was like a meme going around now, like a bunch of old like 90s pictures of The Rock.
Oh, with
Hercules on it. So he's got like a turtleneck and a necklace, and he's like, he's heavy. He's not as trim, so he's like rounder. It's just like turtleneck tucked.
The one I saw, he had like the almost a Kid and Play stovetop, like a little bit shaved on the side, but poofed up on top. Like, that's not a good look for you.
Oh, that's funny. How do we appeal to the average guy, right? Because I have the same sort of perspective as you. Mm-hmm. Even my daughter, when she watches the Disney Channel, right? Like, when Full House was out, and when, like, there was always a role for, like, a lesson from Bob Saget. And that show is, like, still on now. My daughter loves it. That's why I bring it up.
We still watch it every night.
And then, but you watch, like, a newer show, and the parents are dumb.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, any new-ish sitcom, the parents are, like, unimportant, you know, silly. They're the breakaway characters.
Mm-hmm.
They're
the Charlie Brown teachers brought to life.
Right.
And wah, 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 wah. Yeah. Like, they come in, they say something stupid, and they exit stage left. And Ariana Grande comes in and kills with a punchline. I don't know.
Do you have an extension of your opinion on that whole like idea of how to appeal adults' roles or even men's roles in, you know, in entertainment, I guess?
Yeah, like, you know, I struggle with that every day because I am a 48-year-old white guy with a couple of bucks. Like, there's a million of me.
Right.
Like, how am I? Like, I even have a tough time relating to, like, I do improv with 25-year-olds. I'm like, the conversation is good for like 20 minutes, and then I say something, it just right over their head.
Right.
They're like, oh, that's right. That was the 90s. You were in diapers.
Like, what is Area 52?
Yeah. the Beatles. It was a 4-person rock band. Like, oh, man. But yeah, it's a tough, I'm not sure. At this point, I almost feel like it's not even a man-woman thing. It's a generation thing.
Right.
Because I've always related to most people, but now I find it's a little more difficult. There's like the 20-year-olds who I've always gotten along with. When I was 20, I hung out with 30, 40, 50, 60-year-olds.
Right.
And, you know, I've always covered the age gap. Now I find it increasingly more difficult to talk to 20-year-olds. Not that, you know. That sounds like a creepy guy.
No, that's why I was very silent.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be an accomplice.
But, you know, in New York and performing and doing stuff, you run into people of all ages.
Right.
And, you know, I'll hang out with anybody. And then I'm sitting in a bar having a beer and talking with them. And I'm like, oh, yeah, right. I could be your dad. Okay. That's just weird.
Let me moonwalk out of this conversation.
But as far as in the media, like, there's not a lot. I'm never sure. Like I always, like I said, I get the roles. I go audition for the guy who has something to move the story along.
Right.
Like there's either the dumb guy who's going to be the star or the father, or, you know, just the side guy in the back who moves information and says this guy's dead or that car's on fire or something like that.
Yeah.
So I'm not really sure how. There's so many different things that have changed.
Sure.
Generationally, like 10 years ago, when. In 2000, when I was 57 years old, things hadn't changed that much in the 20 years leading up to that point.
Right.
But from 2000 to now,
yeah,
the world has changed exponentially. Like, there's no way my kid can understand how I used to watch three channels.
Right.
Right. But like,
if two, four, and seven.
But 15 years ago, if you were telling somebody who had cable, right. Oh, you got 20 channels? Oh, boy. When I was a kid, we only got 2, 4, and 7. We had to get up and change it with our hands. Like, and that would blow their mind. But now my kid is like, we're going to have dinner. I watch a different Disney movie every night, and he scrolls through and he has every Disney movie ever produced.
Right.
Like, do you remember, like,
I know, like, you know, and I mean, even stuff like the one kind of thing I experienced going away is video stores.
Oh, yeah.
Because my daughter, like, you know, between, let's call it 4 to 7, like, we would go to the video store and then she would go pick up something physically. And like, I would talk to her about that movie. And, you know, like, you take this journey through a physical space and you're able, it becomes a good conversation. Like, every moment's a teaching moment when you're a parent. Where now, like, Netflix is just a matter of scrolling through and it's like half the movies I don't know anyway, because they're like knockoffs, like Hercules 2. Like, wait, there was a sequel, you know, or 105 Dalmatians. Where'd these other three come from?
Every Disney movie comes out like the car. There was one right after Cars, because my kid loved Cars, right. And it was something similar to that. Right. It was like Autos, and it was the worst animation in the world. And he sat there for 20 minutes going, Daddy, what is this? Exactly. It's just horrible. Yeah. But he has Netflix on the iPad.
Right.
And he's good. He's better at it than I am. So he flips through and finds it. And he goes, Daddy, did you watch Breaking Bad last night? Oh, okay. Give me that. Stop looking at that. What are you doing? Come on. Don't look at that. He's cute.
That's why my kids don't get into my Netflix account.
You know? Right next to Me Too.
Speaking of like that whole, you know, the transition, you coming out of a corporate space, entering, you know, more creative entertainment, and then adding technology as a layer to that, you know, and especially from talent discovery, you look at the YouTubes of the world and like, oh, here's my reel, or I'm just going to talk into my webcam. Have you adapted to, you know, the technological use of your 20-year-old peers?
That's, it is. I mean, in 2004, like the shit that was available then compared to what is now,
right.
Like, is infinitely different. Like, there was no YouTube when I quit my job.
Right.
Like, that came out a year later. Right when I was doing the transition, I've always been, I don't want to say cutting edge, but because I worked at Popular Science.
It's Innovation Crush, you can say.
It's Innovation Crush. I'm an early adopter.
Yes, there you go.
I was working at Popular Science.
Now people know what you're talking about.
And I had disposable income. I right. bought a lot of toys.
Right.
You know,
right.
I had all the video games. I had everything. I had my, you know. I had my own Canon XLR-1, you know, the one that Soderbergh would shoot movies on. Like, I had my own. I didn't know how to use it. I would shoot stuff. But there was a, before YouTube, Spacey's company had done Trigger Street. I don't know if you remember that back in the day. You could upload, and I did my first short in the basement, and I was trying to do creative stuff like that. That now I could do in 10 minutes with my phone.
Right.
But I had this expensive camera and I was doing it on my ginormous G5 iMac. But I was always trying to stay ahead. So luckily, when the new stuff came in, I was able to incorporate it.
Right.
I wasn't great at some aspects of it. I took that corporate mindset of, all right, you know, you gotta grease the palms. You got to take care of these people. I would go meet with casting directors. In New York, you meet a handful of casting directors and, hey, send them a note. Thanks so much. You know, have a couple of coffees on me and send them a $50 Starbucks gift certificate.
Right.
Because that's what I did in corporate world.
You never hear back from them again.
I would hear back like, don't do that.
Oh, wow.
Like, some people were borderline offended. Some were like, that's not necessary. And I didn't know until I started getting into it more. Like, my peers, even like older guys like me who should have money, they still don't have any money and they can't even afford like a $50 class.
Right.
Like, so to be sending, I guess that was considered an exorbitant gift to be sending to a casting director. So I guess I was coming across as kind of a douche, like trying to buy. I'm like, I just want to be nice to people because that's my corporate back.
There's, you know, no backstory. Place for nice people in Hollywood.
There really isn't. I mean, imagine if I went around in LA just passing out $50 Apple iTunes store cards. Here you go, buddy. Here's a card. Hey, help me out. Don't forget Stevie B. But there was also – there were a lot of hurdles.
Right.
So there was that social one. The technical stuff, I've always tried to stay ahead of. Like, I had my own – like, I got the Steve Belanger domain.
Right.
Before people had their own domains. Like, now everybody has their own URL in this. And I've heard from a couple of Steve Belangers. Like, yeah, you bastard. You got there before I did. Like, I have my Twitter handle. Like, I have everything in my name. Yeah.
You should get them all together and just do, like, a Steve Belanger party.
I just got an email from somebody that I know in L.A. she's at some Vancouver festival. She's like, are you here in Vancouver? Steve Belanger signed in front of me. I'm like, that's not possible. It's not a common name. But yeah, no, I still, you know, I got my own website.
Right.
I shoot video. I've done shorts.
And then I think one of the biggest hurdles, right? Not even hurdle, but just is the need to sort of self-market, right? In a way that's organic and not like me, but like, how do you participate in the social and digital conversation? You know, especially as this is, relatively speaking, a new-ish career move for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you approach that part of self-promotion? Especially when you come from a corporate background where you're like, hey, here's marketing team, do this. Like, you are the marketing team.
It's tough. And it's so much easier to, you know, have people promote you than to promote yourself.
Yep.
You know? I mean, I remember when I started doing stand-up, I was barking in Manhattan. And you know what that is?
No.
For the comedy clubs, to get a spot, they'd hand you a stack of flyers, and you'd
go to
Times Square. Comedy show? Comedy? Come to comedy. Come see live comedy. Because famous stars. Come see comedy. I'm like, I'd be standing there doing that just feeling like shit because I make six figures. You know, an hour ago, I was wearing a suit and making $200,000 a year. I'm now asking tourists to come see me do stand-up. That side of it, I just was never good at.
Right.
And when I was doing it, there was no social media.
Right.
You know, I would invite friends. Like, you had to do word of mouth.
Yeah.
Now, I've you try.
Yeah.
You know, now that I had the Men's Health podcast, so they would promote it. That helped. I would promote that because it's, you know, it wasn't come see me, come look at me.
Right.
And it was not
you
like.
You were giving people a product, like you were giving them something that was valuable.
Yeah, it's not me talking, you know, come listen to me and me be so witty. No, it's come hear me talk to Henry Winkler for an hour. Come hear me sit down with Adrian Peterson and you know, Barry Sanders. These are some cool people. Come listen to this.
Right.
And now I have my own show here at Sideshow. I still interview the same kind of level of people.
Yep.
So I don't feel too bad hawking that. But when I do other stuff, like my book, like I had a hard time marketing that because it's
right.
Like, I'm so cool. Come look at my book. I don't know.
Did you ever discover a formula? Because the fact that you actually did pass out the flyers, right? Like, you know, most people, like, that's where you stop, right? I remember in college, I had it was like a winter break, and I had a job where I had to put on like a giant Dracula head, and it was cold, and it was like, go rent these.
I have
apartments.
To clarify that. Was it Dracula or Blackula?
It was Dracula, which even and then I had an identity crisis. So
you were like,
I was like, I can't even get the black Dracula head. I did that job for 2 hours.
You know, and Oreo is always coming up with these new flavors. They need like an Oreo Dracula Blackula.
I think so. I think Mulatto Dilla.
I had Mulatto for dessert last night. Delicious. Mm.
What was her name?
Hey. Yeah, but I mean, I did like you said, you wore it for 2 hours.
Yeah, but
I barked a couple of times,
right?
And I was like, oh, I just can't do this.
So, that raises an interesting point, just in that idea of like finding a product or a service that you can actually do that you love that also works to in tandem.
Our table is ready.
Exactly. Well, nice meeting you. No, but that like finding something that works in tandem. So it's not necessarily marketing. It is a product that serves a purpose of marketing, but it's organic to who you are.
Yeah. I mean, that is the dream goal, you know.
Right.
With the book, I was able to kind of give me a reason to go on shows and talk about Penthouse and my career and different stuff. So it didn't feel like, look at me. At least with the book, I had a physical product.
Right.
And now with the podcast, I can go on and talk about the podcast and the interviews I do. A lot of times I'll come on shows and be interviewed about, I'm like the quit your job and follow your dreams guy.
That's what I wrote down as potentially the title essence of this episode. So
I've done so many of those interviews about like on Donny Deutsch and CNBC and all these shows. And I'm like, I get a ton of emails afterwards saying, oh, I want to do what you did. And I write back to everybody and I really tell them like, think it over. Like I've done well.
Right.
But it's not the norm. And I've only done well because I had, you know, a big pot of money set aside.
But that's the whole point. Nobody wants the norm. Like, and people are afraid to not abandon it, right? And do something like they're either really passionate about. And like, I feel like it's a conversation. You hear that message a lot, right? Mm-hmm. You don't hear from a lot of people who've done it.
Yeah. That's what it was. Like, everybody has that dream. but not that many of us follow it. Right. Not that many people are like me, stupid enough to do it. But there are times you did stand up.
Yep.
Like, how many times did you run into people? Oh man, my friends always tell me I should go into stand up, dude.
Right,
and I said,
right.
No, you shouldn't. You know? Very few people should. I probably shouldn't have.
Right.
But it's just not for everybody.
Yeah.
And the same thing with following your dream. Like, whatever your dream is, like, just think it through. Be prepared to fail.
Right.
You know, I knew that if I didn't do well at this, which I am doing borderline well enough to keep going.
Right.
But I always
I'm entertained, by the way, just so you
know. Oh, thank you. Yeah. I'm very good at doing things that don't make a lot of money. If I got paid $2,000 to guest on podcasts, I'd be very successful. But I am, you know, still kind of living my dream.
Right.
I mean, every week I talk to some of my acting and music idols, you know. Mm-hmm. I have somehow through this business got some amazing friends that are people I've worshipped for decades.
Right.
It's a pretty cool life. And the best part of quitting my job was that it let me raise my two sons.
Yeah.
I never would have quit, as horrible as that is to say, as a human being. No way I was going to quit that kind of six-figure job to take care of my sons.
Right.
Like, it just – nobody does that. But I did, and it allowed me that opportunity. I mean, I've been –
It was like a perk.
It was a perk.
Yeah.
I quit in 2004. My first son came along in 2007.
Right.
And my wife and I were like, I'm home. You know, maybe this is the time to do it. Let's start the family.
Brandy 413.
Brandy to the stage, please. Coming up next, Brandy to the stage. It's the worst strip joint ever. Fire truck.
Yeah, there you go. That's the name of the strip club.
But the fact that's still all the other stuff is – to the sidelines of being able to be home with my kids 24/7 for all this time is amazing.
Aside from don't do it, what advice do you give those individuals? Like, what are some of the practical steps? Like, is it do your research or do it gently, or do you like jump parachute feet first or no parachute even? Like, what
I say, make sure you have some kind of support. I had a loving, supportive wife. Like, If your family thinks it's a crappy idea, like, you need your friends to support you. Like, no man is an island, no woman is an island.
Right.
It's a hard thing to do on your own. Those first couple of years, I had a lot of breakdowns because shit just didn't go my way. My wife was supportive. My friends were still crazy supportive. You need whoever it is, even if it's one person, you need somebody in your corner. You need to do the research. You can't just say, I've always wanted to open a cupcake store. And then, you know, quit your job and on Monday start looking around and go, wait, there are 8 fucking cupcake stores 40 feet from my house.
Right.
Whatever that dream is, you have to kind of plot it out. And I explained, for 3 years, I led the dual lifestyle. You can't succeed doing that, but you should do it for a while just to make sure that's what you want to do.
Right.
Because if I had said, I'm going to quit my job to be a stand-up, quit my job, and then the next day went on stage for the first time, that shit wouldn't have gone well.
Right, right.
Right? You need to live in that world for a little bit just to make sure it's still what you think it is and you think you want to do it forever.
Yeah. And then, like, was there anything in terms of, like, I know you, just in terms of listening to that voice, right? And I don't know, like, some people are, like, the security gets to them, right? Like, you know, just as far as like the change in lifestyle, how did that affect your family, right? Like, once your wife says yes and she's supportive and gung ho, and you said like 2 years later, you're like, uh-oh. Like, what was the dynamic then? How did that go?
One of the ideal things was that we didn't lead an exorbitant lifestyle.
Right.
Like, I did when I started making a lot of money. We didn't live up to that lifestyle. She didn't come from money. I was poor as shit as a kid. Like, you know, having a couple of bucks around, yes, I would play golf, and yes, I'd have all the toys. But, you know, I would just keep paying down my mortgage. Like, I didn't burn through it as soon as
living
I got
living below your means.
We never go out to dinner. Like, even before we had kids, we led a quiet life, just happy to be together and hanging out. So when the money stopped coming in, things really didn't change that much.
Right.
The big change was the kids, because then the money started flying out pretty quick.
Trust me.
But it still wasn't like now it's getting a little scary just because I'm starting to think college, you know, and I'm starting to make those financial moves to make sure they're taken care of.
Yeah.
Because they're probably going to be as smart as me, which is not bode well for them. Hopefully they get the mom's looks.
You are you're also Henry Winkler certified.
I am. I am. My that's still one of the things that boggles my mind is that I'm friends and buddies with Henry Winkler.
Because I heard episode 18 of your podcast.
Okay, good.
He was a guest. Like I wrote down one of the things because he's like, I really enjoy being on this earth, which I feel like is just such a profound statement.
He really is one of those. He's just so genuine like that. Yeah. He's just happy to be alive.
So how did that relationship come about for you, just out of curiosity?
A buddy of mine, Joel Stein, who writes for Time Magazine,
mm-hmm.
We were having dinner one night and we were talking, and he's one of those guys, he always interviews celebrities,
right?
Which is kind of what I do, and I think, oh, you must be friends with him. He's like, no, I'm not friendly with any of them. I'm like, oh, I stay in touch with everybody I talk to. And again, I think that's just my kind of crazy mindset, like that. Right. I just think that's how life works.
Yeah,
I'm friends with William Hurt, the actor.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
You know, we worked for a day on a TV show, you know, and I just pal around with everybody. And 2 days later, we were playing golf, and we've been friends ever since. So Joel had mentioned that he just talked to Henry Winkler. I'm like, oh, I would love to chat with Henry. You know,
yeah.
For this is when I was doing the Men's Health show, and he's like, all right, let me send him an email. And 20 minutes later, I got a message. Stephen, this is Henry. Joel says wonderful things about you. I'd love to do whatever you want to do. Call me. I'm like, oh my God, Fonzie just called me. And I played the message for my wife. I'm like, look, Fonzie just called your husband. And then I interviewed him for Men's Health, and he couldn't have been nicer. Like we talked
right
afterwards, and he found out that my acting career, give me your headshot, give me your stuff. Like within 2 weeks, I was auditioning for Royal Pains in New York.
Oh, nice.
So he hooked that up. And we've just stayed in touch. He just did my other show.
Now, with those kind of like profound statements, right, he seems like a very enlightened guy, right, mm-hmm. listening to the show. I know like when I talk to guests, like I'm always pulling something personal mm-hmm. out of their stories. Like, oh my gosh, like, you know, whether it's, a life lesson or, oh, I should think about something that way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what do you pull from your guests? Like, what's the experience like for you being in the conversation, you know, being on this side of the of the table?
What I always pull is, I think this is what served me well for years with Men's Health and now my own show is, I'll talk to anybody. Everybody's got a cool story.
Right.
Right? I mean, I just happen to talk to mostly big name people. But I enjoy talking to, you know, even any like writers, anybody who has a story to tell, because I love the journeys.
Right.
Everybody has that different story.
Yeah.
But there's always one or two moments that if shit didn't go A to B, it would have been a whole different journey for them. And I know that's the same way with me. You know, if 9/11 hadn't happened, I don't know if I would have had the balls to pursue all of this.
Really? So that was a defining moment for you.
I was in Manhattan. I was kind of starting to do the picking up the writing thing again, and I had just taken like two acting classes. Going, oh, maybe, and then you know, shit, the world changed, and we were, you know, I was on 33rd Street,
right,
in the shadow of the Empire State Building.
Yeah,
my wife, you know, running to my building for coverage. And all of a sudden, you know, all of us huddled in my office going, oh, the next tallest building is right there. Like not knowing what the fuck was going to happen. So not to over dramatize it.
No, that's great.
That's a horrible word. Dramatization
is one.
but from the morning after that period, I was like, okay, a job, you know, money is money, but, you know, do what you want to do.
Life is life.
Like, yeah. I've always thought I love stand up. We're looking at a picture of Robin Williams now, Johnny Carson. These are guys I admire.
Rodney Dangerfield was just
fantastic people. Woody Allen, please.
Yeah. Let's read them all.
And I was like, all right, that's
Henry Winkler is on the wall.
That's my buddy.
Boom.
That's something I wanted to try. And these are, you know, I started doing the acting, the improv. I just started doing throwing spaghetti against the wall. Right. I just wanted to try everything.
Well, you thrust yourself into that world fully. Like you were committed at that point.
At that point. And, you know, the fears just went away. It was like, all right, just try it. Just do it. And I fell in love with it. And it's been a hell of a ride. But that's when I talk to people, like that's what I try and get out of them is like that, relive that joy, relive the journey.
Right.
Because everybody loves, once they get into it, that sometimes they go, yeah, that A to B. Yeah. Boy, that is quite a, I guess they all, everything lined up.
And I like looking at how people are, you know, especially at a point of success, are a perfect storm of their experiences, mm-hmm. right? Like, I talked to a guy, it wasn't even on the show, but it was just in a meeting, like, super brilliant dude. And he was like, my dad was in the military, and he was always about perfection, and I read a lot of books, and then, you know, and then when he was 12, he almost drowned. So he had, like, the discipline plus the drowning equals a different perspective mm-hmm. on the, you know, just...
It gives him a different filter than right. you and I would have.
Yep. And so not even just the A to B, but just like the whole amalgamation. I was even talking to my wife earlier, like, you know, if this hadn't happened and this hadn't happened and this hadn't happened, we probably wouldn't have met. Like,
absolutely.
You know? And some of the stuff that happened along the way was, you know, wasn't very pleasant, mm-hmm. right? And some of it was awesome. But, you know, if certain things hadn't happened in your life, you know, and it can go dark. You know, when Sugar Ray Leonard was a guest on the show, yeah. he was talking about how he wrote in his book about being molested yeah. as a kid.
He's got some
but
stuff.
Part of that was like anger that came out in the ring. Mm-hmm. And
which know. He might not have had
exactly
to become the champ.
Yeah.
When I in some of those dark times, like when I had quit my job and things weren't going well.
Right. And the cocaine habit kicked in high gear.
And you know, I could only keep so many dead hookers under the bed, the arms that keep slipping at. you know, there were times when I would go to like the dark side of I guess the word is regret. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm too old to be doing this. You know, damn, well, why didn't I jump into this when I was 20 when I should have done it? And right. I'm like, that kind of got washed away. Because eventually, I don't know if it's as you mature and get a little bit older, like if I would have done it when I was 20, it wouldn't have been probably any good. And if it was really good, I wouldn't have been able to handle the success that I would have hoped would have come very my true. Way. So everything, it just sounds such a cliche, like chicken soup for my asshole comment, but everything does happen for a reason. Like yes. there is horrible shit that happens to us,
yep.
But you get better because of it, or you change your filter, or you change your pathways because of it. Regret's kind of not there for me anymore.
Right.
You know, I try
to bring it back to you.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
So
it's the most expensive therapy session ever. Son of a bitch.
So, the show is called Innovation Crush.
Yes.
You know, it's a double entendre.
Oh, je ne sais pas. Yeah,
exactly. Oh, good.
Thank you. 9 years of French.
me too.
And that's all I got.
Whole other sidebar. I can't speak a lick.
That merde.
So it's like things that you're crushing on or either people who are crushing it. What out there in the world that you see today are you that you look at and you go, oh my gosh, that is amazing. I hope that there's more of that.
It almost sounds like I don't put myself in their category, but I look at guys like Marin and Louis C.K. Mm-hmm. Like that is the epitome. Like, cause I'm never going to be like this great actor. Like I do my shtick
right.
and it's fine, but I could play a version of me. So either if it's a talk show where I do what I kind of do on the podcast and just get it out there more in the world, or Marin's podcast is amazing, but the fact that they both have those sitcoms right. that are kind of them, veiled versions of them, but they are in so much control of, I love that because I'm a control freak.
Sure.
So that's what I would really crush on. Because again, back to the marketing conversation, like I don't like to parse out anything. Yeah. I do everything myself because I've been doing it that way for 10 years.
Yep.
And I don't know if that's helping or hurting me, but that's the only way I know how to do it.
You want to own the vision, too, you know, to
I want to own the vision. And yeah, you know, it's not much of a vision. I'm a doughy, middle-aged white guy. Like,
but you get it. Like, I think you, the one thing you have in that, you know, even in that statement is clarity, right? Some people don't know their lane. Like, and it's okay to be, you know, in that second tier. Right?
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of room there, and it's fun, right?
Absolutely.
Last but not least.
Hit me.
Innovation to me is
shark-like. Sharks have to keep moving. I feel like you have to keep, now I feel like I've done so well for decades staying an early adopter. Now I feel like sometimes shit gets past me.
Right,
like they'll put one through the five hole, and I go, "Wait, what, Tinder? What is what now? What is Grindr? Wait, what are people doing out there?" So I think with innovation, you have to keep. You just have to keep up,
yeah.
Which there's so many things out there now that I'm not going to use, like Grindr or Tinder. One of them's the gay one. I don't understand.
Grindr.
Is Grindr
the right answer? Okay.
It's Grindr. I mixed up my LinkedIn and my Grindr accounts, and shit just got really weird there
hey,
for a
babe.
Week.
Oh, uh-oh.
please disregard that picture that I exactly. group CC'd.
Change profile pic.
and, you know, I try to stay – I've been podcasting for 5 years. You've been doing it for a while. Like, we're kind of ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
Not in the podcasting world, but in the general world.
Yes.
Like, people are just catching on to podcasting.
Right.
That's the kind of thing you want. I don't want to be first, and I don't want to be in the middle. I want to be in that sweet spot right in between those two. Right. I don't want to be last.
Exactly.
But I never buy the first iPhone.
Right.
Like, when it comes out, I'll sit back. And then 2 months later, once they get all the bugs fixed, I'll take one.
You're like, now I'm good. Yes.
Now I'm good. Hey.
Like, but even I look at that as a piece of innovation, right? Is like opportunities to improve and rethink things, mm-hmm. right? Like, you're not going to, not everybody's going to invent, you know, the latest innovative thing. Most times it's going to be an improvement or a new use of, or, you know, a new way to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
But the origination of whatever that thing is, you know, may not necessarily come from the innovator.
Right? I'm never going to be the guy who comes up with the newest thing.
Right.
But I like seeing what people have done and building on that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not a genius. I'm not that smart. But I
beg to differ, but continue.
I'm confident enough. I'm quick. You know, I have a certain wit. I can do. I know my toolbox. Don't look at Anthony. He can't tell you. He can't tell you anything.
I saw somebody come in with a bag of food. I was like, oh, I thought that. But it's
table 17. Exactly. Table 17. Your order is ready.
Brittany.
So I don't want to be a follower, but I like playing off of what other people have done.
Right.
But as soon as everybody, like, if everybody in the world starts getting a podcast, it's going to lose its appeal to me because.
Do you like Mitch Hedberg?
I do.
Because as we were doing the whole party a bit,
yep.
You know, his Dufresne joke. Dufresne, party of five. Like, he's sitting at a restaurant, Dufresne, party of five. And then he said, they didn't go, and he's like, Miller, party of three. And he's like, wait a minute. What happened to the Dufresnes? We need to find them. Like, he talks about how they must be missing. And like, he goes on this whole tangent about a search party. And on that note, I want to thank you.
Thank you, Christopher.
For,
can I call you that? I think we're close enough
you
now.
Call me, yeah. You can call me whatever.
You've been sitting on my lap for an hour. I think it's the time we.
It's a mutual sweat. I don't know who's sweating more, me or you.
I think they've blended together as one.
Lap sweat.
It's like the worst True Blood episode ever.
That's a good name for a strip club. Lap sweat.
Lap
sweat.
Oh.
And on that note, again, let's. This has been another installment of Innovation Crush. Thank you, Steve Belanger.
Thank you, Christopher.
How can people find you, by the way?
StevBelanger.com. On Twitter, I'm at Steve Belanger. And just come to my house. I'm sitting there changing diapers and watching Dora.
Oh, nice. All right. Sounds like a great time. Thank you, everybody. We'll talk to you next time.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schlesinger, I've been friends with her for 10 years, one of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore. Because it's here. And it's funny. And I love you.